Can you hear that? Can you hear that? It's my voice pouring through your radio device to you. I am Sister C, your own Charlotte Farrell, here at CJSF Radio 90.1 in Burnaby, streaming worldwide at cjsf.ca. I'm here to recognize you as the most important aspect of the radio we make. That's right, radio is all about you, your choices, your interest in knowing what's going on around the world, your interest in hearing music that you may not hear other places, new music by new musicians, new music by indigenous people of African descent, people of all ethnicities, welcome to produce and share their music. So, thanks to you, we are able to provide diverse programming to best fit your ears. Let us know how we're doing, and we will keep striving to make it the best you hear anywhere.
Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm Michael Robert Kaditz, and I am here today with Zalek Siegel. So the Canadian Philosophy Show is expanding to include members of the community and to, at times, emphasize contemporary topics. So I found Zalek Siegel, a member of the community in Vancouver, because Zalek wrote a very interesting essay, a short essay, discussing the current Middle East conflict, the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. And Zalek's essay caught my attention because of its unique approach, a different approach than what I have been witnessing on media, social media, in discussions with friends. And Zalek's approach, as expressed in his short essay, I believe has philosophical content, in that it's not simply your typical argument of who's right and who's wrong with regards to the Middle East conflict. It's not taking sides. Most of the information and the content and the discussion that I hear these days is very polarized. Supporters of Israel, supporters of Palestine. But what Zalek expresses is a very unique view, which I believe goes a lot deeper, goes to psychology, it goes to history, goes to interpersonal relationships. It goes much deeper and transcends your typical debate these days, which is very tribal and very polarized. So I invited Zalek to be on this show, this edition of the Canadian Philosophy Show, and hopefully Zalek will elaborate and discuss with me some of the points that I thought were very relevant and very unique and very philosophical, and spoke to a possible new approach to this seemingly intractable, decades-old conflict between Israel and its Palestinian and Arab neighbors. So with your permission, Zalek, I would like to pick out a few of the phrases, a few of the passages in your essay that I thought were very important, and have you discuss with me those points and maybe elaborate on them and help me understand, if I don't already, precisely what you're suggesting. So how does that sound, Zalek?
Sounds great. I appreciated your analysis or your description of what I wrote. Sounds really good. Thank you.
First, do you agree with my characterization? Maybe you don't. Do you agree with my characterization that your approach is somewhat unique and it transcends the typical partisan debate that's happening now.
Yeah, it was gratifying to hear you describe it like that. That is what I was attempting to do.
Good. So the first passage that I was impressed by is this one. Perhaps if violence becomes untenable for all sides to this current outbreak of conflict, historians will call this the Hundred Years' War, because the roots of war between Israel and the Palestinians were planted well before the state was formally established in 1948. I'm curious what you see as those roots of war before that were planted before the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948. And the reason I'm curious about that is because I think normally people think that it was the establishment of Israel in 1948 that was the beginning of the conflict, because the conventional wisdom is that the Jews that were living in Palestine and the Arabs lived somewhat peacefully side by side. And the problem began when the Jews declared the State of Israel and either drove out the Palestinians, and or the Palestinians got scared and left, or they left on their own volition. And there's a factual dispute about what exactly happened. But I'm curious about what were those roots of war that were planted before the establishment of Israel?
That part of my opinion came from the book called The Roots of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, 1929. 1929 was also a culmination of events that took place before 1929. But in 1929 was when there were riots that broke out. The Arabs attacked the Jewish communities in a couple of cities. And then the counterattack. And so 1929, in this author's opinion, was in essence a flashpoint from which everything else followed. And I suppose typically you could also say everything that started maybe in the late 1800s, 1880s, when the first major emigration to Israel took place, that might also have been the beginning. But it was probably somewhere in between, and not all events were responsible for what followed. Does that make sense?
Right. Yes. Seems like this relates to another passage in your essay, which says, one might even suggest this conflict is a family feud and will be resolved when the descendants of Isaac and Ishmael make peace with each other. So it seems to me that you're suggesting that the roots of the conflict go all the way back to biblical times. And I'm going to embellish this with something that I'm adding. I don't know if you agree with it, but it seems to me that there's something in the Bible that suggests that God gave the land of Israel to Isaac rather than to Ishmael. And so Jews, especially fundamentalist Jews, claim that they have a biblical right to the land of Israel because God gave that land to Isaac to lead his people, whereas Ishmael, being the father of the Arab people, were not favored by God in that way. How would you characterize that assertion?
Say that's a rabbit hole that lots of people go down, but I don't think is really pertinent or helpful or anything like that. I'd suggest that far more than the biblical references, even in the Bible, in Genesis, what you have in Genesis are examples of family conflict. And family conflict is universal. So the Hatfield and the, which I understand was a generations long feud, is part of that. In my own family, there are siblings who don't speak to other siblings. I hear that And there's a quotation later that I picked up from someplace that says, in any time you have a conflict or where you have a designated problem, patient, the source of that lies in the system, the family itself, not the individual. So when I related this conflict back to the first people, it was more of an exploration of an idea rather than the root cause.
You say another element that makes this conflict so unique in world history is that this battle is seen by all parties to the conflict as a battle for the very existence of the be it Israel and Zionism or Palestinian nationalism and national identity. With that statement, are you setting the aspirations of the Jews, of the Zionists, and the aspirations of the Palestinians on an equal footing? Is there an equivalency there where each family, yes, so to speak?
Yes.
Yeah. They see because, each side, because, right. Yeah.
Because each side, the importance of identity, the importance of who one is, whether it's or a particular individual, is universal. That's why I say it applies to both sides. Both sides are, and this is close reading. I'm not a historian. I don't read a lot, but somewhere at one point I read somewhere in Ben Gurion's, the founding president of the state, prime minister of the state, came to the conclusion that what the Jews wanted in Palestine, the Arabs wanted equally. That is a national identity, a national state, a state. And it was his conclusion at the same time that there was not going to be a peaceful meeting of the minds on this context, with this concept. And that was pretty eye-opening to me. It's been consistent, and there's always voices who, even all through the 100 years, the heads of the Israeli intelligence agencies, some recognize that this is a natural outcome of peoples wanting to have their own identity and their own national state. Now, there's when I say that, my mind goes to First Nations in this country or in the United States. The First Nations, how come they didn't? There are stories of rebellion. Maybe they were just outnumbered, and at that time, 200 years ago, it was acceptable to just kill people, wipe out the opposition. Not so acceptable these days, even though it still happens. So I don't quite, I'm curious. There's a counterpoint to what's happening in Israel and Palestine, and here in Canada, and how these two nation states are coexisting.
So is that why, or one of the reasons why, the Middle East conflict seems so intractable? Because each side sees it as an existential battle for its very existence?
I'd say the reason it's so intractable is because of the political leadership that promote one side, one argument or another argument, dogma, religion, and you have these leaders on both sides, perhaps at different times. That's one reason why it's so intractable, because of the leadership. Secondly, there's an element that I'm not real clear about, why people support the leaders that choose war. I don't understand that. Whether it's the Middle East, whether it's in the United States, Europe. So as George Carlin said, you know, never underestimate the power of large groups of stupid people.
You say, Zelick, the following. I describe peace as the condition where all parties are getting needs met without preventing the needs of the other parties from being fulfilled. That's a different definition of peace than I'm used to hearing.
Well, what's your definition?
I wouldn't say it's my definition, but what I often hear is peace is the absence of war, right? Peace is when there aren't battles happening, when there's not violence. And so, for example, right now I'm hearing Israeli leaders saying that they are striving for peace by wiping out Hamas. So, in other words, the war to end all wars type of argument, which has been made many times, that Israel will not stop its attack, its war on Gaza until they've wiped out Hamas. And the argument is that that will finally bring peace. Now, that's a different definition of peace than yours. So you're saying that is when all parties are getting their needs met without preventing the needs of other parties. That's I think, one of the very important, unique approaches that you're suggesting in your papers. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit? Why do you see peace as in that way rather than the absence of war?
I see peace that way because the absence of war, to my thinking, implies a power over a relationship rather than a power with relationship. Even, and this is my experiences in personal relationships, in a marriage or whatever personal relationship one is in, even a friendship, I find the greatest satisfaction for myself is when we come to that situation in which my universal needs are getting met as well as the other person's universal needs are getting met. And should the situation arise that somehow, no matter what, we have not been able to achieve needs from both parties getting met, then we can choose to extricate ourselves from that relationship without violence perpetrated on the other. The aspiration is, for me, is to achieve the situation where we find a way, one finds a way so that needs are met. The strategies, we are able to create strategies whereby these needs are getting. Yeah, it's interesting because when the Oslo Accords were, when they fell apart, I had an interview with an Israeli tactician, politician, and he said he had encouraged Rabin, the then president of the prime minister of Israel, to not do this piecemeal, but to stay with the process until you had a complete agreement. And that didn't take place. They didn't get a complete agreement. It was a piecemeal agreement, which ultimately broke down, apparently. So that, to me, speaks of a cautionary note that you keep at it until you are able to ensure that needs are getting met, all needs are getting met. And if that's not possible, then you extricate, you change the relationship without violence. And that's the Yeah, that's the conundrum for nation states. Because violence, it's interesting. Because violence is an acceptable response to conflict throughout the world. That's what changes.
It's normative. It's what's expected, and that is what you're arguing against, I think, in your paper. You're suggesting that normative response to conflict, which is violence, and then ultimately power over someone winning the war has power over, you're suggesting that is not peace at all.
Right.
Because needs aren't being fulfilled. It's just power over.
And give it enough time, somebody will rebel against that.
So it's an unstable, unsustainable situation. Power over is unsustainable.
It's unsustainable it's unsustainable if you take power away. If you remove violence, you can't sustain that kind of relationship. Power over relationship will only... It seems to me that you can sustain a power over a relationship as long as one is willing to exercise violence.
So in politics or philosophy of politics, we talk about the unsustainable situation that you're describing, which is power over, as a temporary way of maintaining quote unquote peace.
Okay.
In the sense of lack of war, that's called a modus vivendi.
Okay.
And John, a contemporary political theorist who we learn about in philosophy of politics, talks about modus vivendi as being that situation where there is a seemingly peaceful, elusive peace that exists in the world between nations when power dictates stability and control, an apparent stability, which is actually a short-term stability. So whoever has the most power and whoever wins the wars and whoever has the military might can impose its will on other countries. And then what we have seemingly is a stable situation. But Rawls argues that it's not actually stable in the long term, because as soon as there's a shift in power, there's a destabilization.
Because
as soon as there's a shift in power, as soon as a country which, say, for a period of time has had the stronger military,
yes,
or more resources, yeah, or a strong man politician, for example,
right,
as soon as that reality changes, now you have instability in the world. Because the stability in the world, the modus vivendi, we call it, is dependent upon whoever happens to have the most power at that time. And Rawls argues for a relationship between nations which is not based on a modus vivendi, but rather is based on an overlapping consensus. And I won't go into all the details of that now, but that consensus would be based on something other than who happens to have the most power at that time, but it would be general agreements between nations on shared principles. So suffice it to say, we are talking about something like that now. You are suggesting something which is quite similar, in my view, to what Rawls suggested, which is there's got to be something, some consensus reached among nations and amongst peoples, which creates more long-term stability than simply the illusionary stability of who happens to have more power now and who won the war, or who has the stronger military, or who has the atomic bomb.
Yeah.
Right. So what you're suggesting, it seems to me, is what that overlapping consensus would be some sort of tending to the needs, especially the existential needs of the various parties involved, and agreements based upon need meeting.
Need meeting.
Right. Meeting needs.
No, rather need meeting is a great term.
Yeah, right. Rather than power over.
Yeah.
So, sounds like you're resonating with that characterization.
Yeah. And a woman named Mickey Cashton, also follows that, I think, my limited understanding. She wrote a book or a process called convergent facilitation, where I believe that's exactly what she's attempting to do in the real world within corporations or between corporations, mostly within corporations, within corporate entities, where the facilitation is aimed at converging the various requirements, needs, desires to form a consensus that people are willing to live with without experiencing power over or power under.
So you say, I suggest neither Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, the religious right in Israel, the secular settler movement who promote the concept of the greater Israel are actively seeking peace and generally promote this conflict. So correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm reading that as an assertion by you that none of the parties involved in this conflict are actively seeking peace in the sense that you define peace, which is getting needs met without preventing the needs of the other parties from being fulfilled, that none of the parties are actively seeking peace in that way. And therefore, they are all promoting the conflict by their failure to understand peace and to strive for peace in the sense of meeting the needs of all parties, that they are therefore promoting the conflict.
Somewhat. I don't believe the IDF, the Israel Defense Force, I don't believe the soldiers in the IDF are promoting war, or they want the soldiers do not want to fight. Undoubtedly, there are some in some of the branches of the Israel Defense Forces that enjoy power over relationships. However, the army itself is not there to create war. However, the political parties, and I'd say Netanyahu and his concepts, he's not pursuing peace. Rabin was somebody who was pursuing peace. Hamas does not pursue peace. They undermine peace by simply saying that the only thing they will settle for is the destruction of the state of Israel. The people who believe the Israeli side, the greater Israel from the river to the sea, and it be Israel, also are not promoting peace. And the powers in Iran and Hezbollah, I believe, promote war.
So this brings me to your next comment that I chose, which is, personal responses to parallel situations and their private life are mirrored in the reactions and responses to matters on the national stage. So it seems here you're speaking to the relationship between politics or politicians on the national stage and individuals with their personal responses. So what is that relationship? So how do you, let's say, citizens of Palestine or citizens of Israel or in the IDF or soldiers in the Hamas military wing, how do their personal responses relate to political matters on the national stage? What's that relationship?
I would look at it differently. I'd say, look at the leaders of these various movements. The leadership in Hamas, the leadership in the Likud party, specifically Netanyahu, but you can go outside, Putin, Trump, Biden. And yeah, so what is it that generates their path in life? And I'm suggesting that what people do as adults is deeply, deeply rooted in their psycho-emotional upbringing.
So you're talking about the politician.